A Brief History of a Brief History. This essay was originally published in December 1988 as an article in the newspaper The Independent. I'm still rather taken aback by the reception given to my book, A Brief History of Time. It has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 37 weeks and on the Sunday Times of London list for 28 weeks. It was published later in Britain than in the United States. It's being translated into 20 languages, 21 if you count American as different from English. This was much more than I expected when I first had the idea in 1982 of writing a popular book about the universe. My intention was partly to earn money to pay my daughter's school fees. In fact, by the time the book actually appeared, she was in her last year of school. But the main reason was that I wanted to explain how far I felt we had come in our understanding of the universe, how we might be near finding a complete theory that would describe the universe and everything in it. If I were going to spend the time and effort to write a book, I wanted it to get to as many people as possible. My previous technical books had been published by Cambridge University Press. That publisher had done a good job, but I didn't feel that it would really be geared to the sort of mass market that I wanted to reach. I therefore contacted a literary agent, Al Zuckerman, who'd been introduced to me as the brother-in-law of a colleague. I gave him a draft of the first chapter and explained that I wanted it to be the sort of book that would sell in airport bookstalls. He told me there was no chance of that. It might sell well to academics and students, but a book like that couldn't break into Jeffrey Archer territory. I gave Zuckerman a first draft of the book in 1984. He sent it to several publishers and recommended that I accept an offer from Norton, a fairly upmarket American book firm. But I decided instead to take an offer from Bantam, a publisher more oriented towards the popular market. Though Bantam had not specialized in publishing science books, its books were widely available in airport bookstalls. That it accepted my book was probably because of the interest in it taken by one of its editors, Peter Guzzardi. He took his job very seriously and made me rewrite the book to make it understandable to non-scientists like himself. Each time I sent him a rewritten chapter, he sent back a long list of objections and questions he wanted me to clarify. At times, I thought the process would never end, but he was right. It is a much better book as a result. Shortly after I accepted Bantam's offer, I got pneumonia. I had to have a tracheostomy operation that removed my voice. For a time, I could communicate only by raising my eyebrows when someone pointed to letters on a card. It would have been quite impossible to finish the book but for the computer program I had been given. It was a bit slow, but then I think slowly, so it suited me quite well. With it, I almost completely rewrote my first draft in response to Guzzardi's urgings. I was helped in this revision by one of my students, Brian Witt. I had been very impressed by Jacob Bronowski's television series, The Ascent of Man. Such a sexist title would not be allowed today. It gave a feeling for the achievement of the human race in developing from primitive savages only 15,000 years ago to our present state. I wanted to convey a similar feeling for our progress towards a complete understanding of the laws that govern the universe. I was sure that nearly everyone was interested in how the universe operates, but most people cannot follow mathematical equations. I don't care much for equations myself. This is partly because it's difficult for me to write them down, but mainly because I don't have an intuitive feeling for equations. Instead, I think in pictorial terms, and my aim in the book was to describe these mental images in words with the help of familiar analogies and a few diagrams. In this way, I hope that most people will be able to share in the excitement and feeling of achievement in the remarkable progress that has been made in physics in the last 25 years. Still, even if one avoids mathematics, some of the ideas are unfamiliar and difficult to explain. This posed a problem. Should I try to explain them and risk people being confused, or should I gloss over the difficulties? Some unfamiliar concepts, such as the fact that observers moving in different velocities measure different time intervals between the same pair of events, were not essential to the picture I wanted to draw. Therefore, I felt I could just mention them, but not go into depth. But other difficult ideas were basic to what I wanted to get across. There were two such concepts in particular that I felt I had to include. One was the so-called sum over histories. This is the idea that there is not just a single history for the universe. Rather, there is a collection of every possible history for the universe, and all these histories are equally real, whatever that may mean. The other idea, which is necessary to make mathematical sense of the sum of the histories, is imaginary time. With hindsight, I now feel that I should have put more effort into explaining these two very difficult concepts, particularly imaginary time, which seems to be the thing in the book with which people have the most trouble. However, it's not really necessary to understand exactly what imaginary time is, just that it's different from what we call real time. When the book was nearing publication, a scientist, who was sent an advance copy to review for Nature magazine, was appalled to find it full of errors, with misplaced and erroneously labelled photographs and diagrams. He called Bantam, who were equally appalled, and decided that same day to recall and scrap the entire printing. They spent 3 intense weeks correcting and rechecking the entire book, and it was ready in time to be in the bookstores by the April publication date. By then, Time magazine had published a profile of me. Even so, the editors were taken by surprise by the demand. The book is in its 17th printing in America and its 10th in Britain. Why did so many people buy it? It's difficult for me to be sure that I'm objective, so I think I'll go by what other people said. I found most of the reviews, although favourable, rather unilluminating. They tended to follow the formula. Stephen Hawking has Lou Gehrig's disease in American reviews, or motor neurone disease in British reviews. He's confined to a wheelchair, cannot speak, and can only move X number of fingers, where X seems to vary from 1 to 3 according to which inaccurate article the reviewer read about me. Yet he has written this book about the biggest question of all: where do we come from and where are we going? The answer that Hawking proposes is that the universe is neither created nor destroyed. It just is. In order to formulate this idea, Hawking introduces the concept of imaginary time, which I, the reviewer, find a little hard to follow. Still, if Hawking is right, and we do find a complete, unified theory, we shall really know the mind of God. In the proof stage, I nearly cut the last sentence in the book, which was that we would know the mind of God. Had I done so, the sales might have been halved. Rather more perceptive, I felt, was an article in The Independent, a London newspaper, which said that even a serious scientific book, like A Brief History of Time, could become a cult book. My wife was horrified, but I was rather flattered to have my book compared to Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I hope, like Zen, that it gives people the feeling that they need not be cut off from the great intellectual and philosophical questions. Undoubtedly, the human interest story of how I have managed to be a theoretical physicist, despite my disability, has helped. But those who bought the book from the human interest angle may have been disappointed, because it contains only a couple of references to my condition. The book was intended as a history of the universe, not of me. This has not prevented accusations that Bantam shamefully exploited my illness, and that I cooperated with this by allowing my picture to appear on the cover. In fact, under my contract, I had no control over the cover. I did, however, manage to persuade Bantam to use a better photograph on the British edition than the miserable and out-of-date photo used on the American edition. Bantam will not change the American cover, however, because it says that the American public now identifies that with the book. It has also been suggested that people buy the book because they've read reviews of it, or because it's on the bestseller list. But they don't read it. They just have it in the bookcase or on the coffee table, thereby getting credit for having it without taking the effort of having to understand it. I'm sure this happens, but I don't know that it is any more so than for most other serious books, including the Bible and Shakespeare. On the other hand, I know that at least some people must have read it, because each day I get a pile of letters about my book, many asking questions or making detailed comments that indicate that they have read it, even if they don't understand all of it. I also get stopped by strangers on the street who tell me how much they enjoyed it. Of course, I'm more easily identified and more distinctive, if not distinguished, than most authors. But the frequency with which I receive such public congratulations, to the great embarrassment of my 9-year-old son, seems to indicate that at least a proportion of those who buy the book actually do read it. People now ask me what I'm going to do next. I feel I can hardly write a sequel to A Brief History of Time. What would I call it? a longer history of time, beyond the end of time, son of time. My agent has suggested that I allow a film to be made about my life, but neither I nor my family would have any self-respect left if we let ourselves be portrayed by actors. The same would be true to a lesser extent if I allowed and helped someone to write my life. Of course, I can't stop someone from writing my life independently, as long as it's not libelous, but I try to put them off by saying I'm considering writing my autobiography. Maybe I will, but I'm in no hurry. I have a lot of science that I want to do first. A Brief History of Time remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 53 weeks. And in Britain, as of February 1993, it had been on the Sunday Times of London list for 205 weeks. At week 184, it went into the Guinness Book of Records for achieving the most appearances on this list. The number of translated editions is now 33. By April 1993, A Brief History of Time was in its 40th hardcover and 19th paperback printing in the United States, and its 39th hardcover printing in Britain.